interested. Why do you ask?
Oh, no reason, Polly said. She said she might, but Nettie often forgets things.
She strikes me as a woman who has had a hard life, Mr. Gaunt said gravely.
Yes, yes, she has. Polly spoke these words slowly and mechanically. She could not seem to take her eyes from his. Then one of her hands brushed against the edge of a glass display case, and that caused her to break eye contact. A little gasp of pain escaped her.
Are you all right?
Yes, fine, Polly said, but it was a lie. She wasn't even within shouting distance of fine. Mr. Gaunt clearly understood this.
You're not well, he said decisively. Therefore, I'm going to dispense with the small talk. The item which I wrote you about did come in. I'm going to give it to you and send you home.
Give it to me?
Oh, I'm not offering you a present, he said as he went behind the cash register. We hardly know each other well enough for that, do we?
She smiled. He was clearly a kind man, a man who, naturally enough, wanted to do something nice for the first person in Castle Rock who had done something nice for him. But she was having a hard time responding, was having a hard time even following the conversation. The pain in her hands was monstrous. She now wished she hadn't come, and, kindness or no kindness, all she wanted to do was get out and go home and take a pain pill. This is the sort of item a vendor has to offer on trial, if he's an ethical man, that is. He produced a ring of keys, selected one, and unlocked the drawer under the cash register. If you try it for a couple of days and discover it is worthless to you, and I have to tell you that will probably be the case, you return it to me. If, on the other hand, you find it provides you with some relief, we can talk price. He smiled at her. And for you, the price would be rock bottom, I can assure you. She looked at him, puzzled. Relief? What was he talking about?
He brought out a small white box and set it on the counter. He took off the lid with his odd, long-fingered hands and removed a small silver object on a fine chain from the cotton batting inside. It seemed to be a necklace of some sort, but the thing which hung down when Mr. Gaunt tended his fingers over the chain looked like a tea-ball or an oversized thimble. This is Egyptian, Polly. Very old. Not as old as the pyramids, gosh, no, but still, very old. There's something inside it, some sort of herb, I think, although I'm not sure. He wiggled his fingers up and down. The silver tea-ball, if that was what it was, jounced at the bottom of the chain. Something shifted inside, something which made a dusty, slithery sound. Polly found it vaguely unpleasant. It's called an azka, or perhaps an ajka, Mr. Gaunt said. Either way, it's an amulet which is supposed to ward off pain. Polly tried a smile. She wanted to be polite, but really, she had come all the way down here for this? The thing didn't even have any aesthetic value. It was ugly, not to put too fine a point on it.
I really don't think...
I don't either, he said, but desperate situations often call for desperate measures. I assure you it's quite genuine, at least in the sense that it wasn't made in Taiwan. It is an authentic Egyptian artifact. Not quite a relic, but an artifact, most certainly, from the period of the later decline. It comes with a certificate of provenance which identifies it as a tool of bankalitis, or white magic. I want you to take it and wear it. I suppose it sounds silly. Probably it is. But there are stranger things in heaven and earth than some of us dream of, even in our wilder moments of philosophy.
Do you really believe that? Polly asked.
Yes. I've seen things in my time that make a healing medallion or amulet look perfectly ordinary. A fugitive gleam flickered momentarily in his hazel eyes. Many such things. The world's odd corners are filled with fabulous junk, Polly. But never mind that. You are the issue here. Even the other day, when I suspect the pain was not nearly as bad as it is right now, I got a good idea of just how unpleasant your situation has become. I thought this little item might be worth a try. After all, what have you got to lose? Nothing else you've tried has worked, has it?
I appreciate the thought, Mr. Gaunt. Really, I do, but Leland, please. Yes, all right. I appreciate the thought, Leland, but I'm afraid I'm not superstitious. She looked up and saw his bright hazel eyes were fixed upon her. "It doesn't matter if you are or not, Polly, because this is." He wiggled his fingers. The Azka bobbed gently at the end of its chain. She opened her mouth again, but this time no words came out. She found herself remembering a day last spring. Nettie had forgotten her copy of Inside View when she went home. Leafing through it idly, glancing at stories about werewolf babies in Cleveland and a geological formation on the moon that looked like the face of JFK, Polly had come upon an ad for something called the Prayer Dial of the Ancients. It was supposed to cure headaches, stomach aches, and arthritis. The ad was dominated by a black-and-white drawing. It showed a fellow with a long beard and a wizard's hat, either Nostradamus or Gandalf, Polly assumed, holding something that looked like a child's pinwheel over the body of a man in a wheelchair. The pinwheel gadget was casting a cone of radiance over the invalid, and although the ad did not come right out and say so, the implication seemed to be that the guy would be dancing up a storm at the Copa in a night or two. It was ridiculous, of course, superstitious pap for people whose minds had wavered, or perhaps even broken under a steady onslaught of pain and disability. But still, she had sat looking at that ad for a long time, and, ridiculous as it was, she had almost called the 800 number for phone orders given at the bottom of the page. Because sooner or later, a person in pain should explore even the more questionable paths. If it's possible, those paths might lead to relief, Mr. Gaunt said. Isn't that so?
I don't.
Marrow transplants? Cold therapy? Thermal gloves? None of them have worked for you, have they? How do you know about all that? A good tradesman makes it his business to know the needs of his customers, Mr. Gaunt said in his soft, hypnotic voice. He moved toward her, holding the silver chain out in a wide ring with the Azka hanging at the bottom. She shrank from the long hands with their leathery nails. Fear not, dear lady. I'll not touch the least hair upon your head. Not if you're calm, and remain quite still. And Polly did become calm. She did become still. She stood with her hands, still encased in the woolly mittens, crossed demurely in front of her, and allowed Mr. Gaunt to drop the silver chain over her head. He did it with the gentleness of a father turning down his daughter's bridal veil. She felt far away from Mr. Gaunt, from needful things, from Castle Rock, even from herself. She felt like a woman standing high on some dusty plain and under an endless sky, hundreds of miles from any other human being. The Azka dropped against the zipper of her leather car coat with a small clink. Put it inside your jacket, and when you get home, put it inside your blouse as well. It must be worn next to the skin for maximum effect.
I can't put it in my jacket, Polly said in slow, dreaming tones. The zipper. I can't pull down the zipper.
No? Try. So Polly stripped off one of the mittens and tried. To her great surprise, she found she was able to flex the thumb and first finger of her right hand just enough to grasp the zipper's tab and pull it down. There. You see? The little silver ball fell against the front of her blouse. It seemed very heavy to her, and the feel of it was not precisely comfortable. She wondered vaguely what was inside it, what had made that dusty, slithery sound. Some sort of herb, he had said, but it hadn't sounded like leaves or even powder to Polly. It had seemed to her that something in there had shifted on its own. Mr. Gaunt seemed to understand her discomfort. You'll get used to it, and much sooner than you might think. Believe me, you will. Outside, thousands of miles away, she heard more sirens. They sounded like troubled spirits. Mr. Gaunt turned away, and as his eyes left her face, Polly felt her concentration begin to return. She felt a little bewildered, but she also felt good. She felt as if she had just had a short but satisfying nap. Her sense of mixed discomfort and disquiet was gone. "My hands still hurt," she said, and this was true. But did they hurt as badly? It seemed to her there had been some relief, but that could be nothing more than suggestion. She had a feeling that Gaunt had imposed a kind of hypnosis on her in his determination to make her accept the Azka. Or it might only be the warmth of the shop after the cold outside.
I doubt very much if the promised effect is instantaneous, Mr. Gaunt said dryly.
Give it a chance, though. Will you do that, Polly?
She shrugged.
All right. After all, what did she have to lose? The ball was small enough so it would barely make a bulge under a blouse and a sweater. She wouldn't have to answer any questions about it if no one knew it was there, and that would be just fine with her.
Rosalie Drake would be curious, and Alan, who was about as superstitious as a tree stump, would probably find it funny. As for Nettie, well, Nettie would probably be awed to silence if she knew Polly was wearing an honest-to-goodness magic charm, just like the ones they sold in her beloved Inside View.
You shouldn't take it off, not even in the shower, Mr. Gaunt said. There's no need to. The ball is real silver and won't rust.
But if I do? He coughed gently into his hand as if embarrassed.
Well, the beneficial effect of the Azka is cumulative. The wearer is a little better today, a little better still tomorrow, and so on. And that was what I was told, at least.
Told by whom? She wondered.
If the Azka is removed, however, the wearer reverts to his or her former painful state not slowly, but all at once, and then has to wait for days or perhaps weeks in order to regain the lost ground once the Azka is put back on.
Polly laughed a little. She couldn't help it and was relieved when Leland Gaunt joined her.
I know how it sounds, he said, but I only want to help if I can.
Do you believe that?
I do, she said, and I thank you. But as she allowed him to usher her from the shop, she found herself wondering about other things, too. There was the near-trance state she'd been in when he slipped the chain over her head, for instance. Then there was her strong dislike of being touched by him. Those things were very much at odds with the feelings of friendship, regard, and compassion which he projected like an almost visible aura. But had he mesmerized her somehow? That was a foolish idea, wasn't it? She tried to remember exactly what she had felt like when they were discussing the Azka and couldn't do it. If he had done such a thing, it had no doubt been by accident and with her help. More likely, she had just entered the dazed state which too many Percodan sometimes induced. It was the thing she disliked most about the pills. No, she guessed that was the thing she disliked second to the most. What she really hated about them was that they didn't always work the way they were supposed to anymore.
I'd drive you home if I drove, Mr. Gaunt said, but I'm afraid I never learned.
Perfectly all right, Polly said. I appreciate your kindness a great deal.
Thank me if it works, he replied. Have a lovely afternoon, Polly.
More sirens rose in the air. They were on the east side of town, over toward Elm, Willow, Pond, and Ford Streets. Polly turned in that direction. There was something about the sound of sirens, especially on such a quiet afternoon, which conjured up vaguely threatening thoughts, not quite images, of impending doom. The sound began to die out, unwinding like an invisible clock spring in the bright autumn air. She turned back to say something about them to Mr. Gaunt, but the door was shut. The sign reading, "Closed," hung between the drawn shade and the glass, swinging gently back and forth on its string. He had gone back inside while her back was turned, so quietly she hadn't even heard him. Polly began to walk slowly home. Before she got to the end of Main Street, another police car, this one a state police cruiser, blasted past her.
Danforth?
Myrtle Keaton stepped through the front door and into the living room. She balanced the fondue pot under her left arm as she struggled to remove the key Danforth had left in the lock.
Danforth, I'm home.
There was no answer, and the TV wasn't on. That was strange. He had been so determined to get home in time for the kickoff. She wondered briefly if he might have gone somewhere else, up to the Garsons, perhaps, to watch it. But the garage door was down, which meant he had put the car away. And Danforth didn't walk anywhere if he could possibly avoid it, especially not up the view, which was steep.
Danforth, are you here?
Still no answer. There was an overturned chair in the dining room. Frowning, she set the fondue pot on the table and righted the chair. The first threads of worry, fine as cobweb, drifted through her mind. She walked toward the study door, which was closed. When she reached it, she tipped her head against the wood and listened. She was quite sure she could hear the soft squeak of his desk chair.
Danforth, are you in there?
No answer, but she thought she heard a low cough. Worry became alarm. Danforth had been under a great deal of strain lately. He was the only one of the town selectmen who worked really hard, and he weighed more than was good for him. What if he'd had a heart attack? What if he was in there lying on the floor? What if the sound she had heard was not a cough, but the sound of Danforth trying to breathe? The lovely morning and early afternoon they had spent together made such a thought seem horridly plausible. First the sweet build-up, then the crashing letdown. She reached for the knob of the study door, then drew her hand back and used it to pluck nervously at the loose skin under her throat instead. It had taken only a few blistering occasions to teach her that one did not disturb Danforth in his study without knocking, and that one never, never, never entered his sanctum sanctorum uninvited.
Yes, but if he's had a heart attack, or...
She thought of the overturned chair and fresh alarm coursed through her.
Suppose he came home and surprised a burglar. What if the burglar conked Danforth over the head, knocked him out, and dragged him into his study?
She rapped a flurry of knuckles on the door.
Danforth, are you all right?
No answer. No sound in the house but the solemn tick-tock of the grandfather clock in the living room and, yes, she was quite sure of it, the creak of the chair in Danforth's study. Her hand began to creep toward the knob again.
Danforth, are you...
The tips of her fingers were actually touching the knob when his voice roared out at her, making her leap back from the door with a thin scream.
Leave me alone! Can't you leave me alone, you stupid bitch!
She moaned. Her heart was jackhammering wildly in her throat. It was not just surprise. It was the rage and unbridled hate in his voice. After the calm and pleasant morning they had spent, he could not have hurt her more if he had caressed her cheek with a handful of razor blades.
Danforth, I thought you were hurt.
Her voice was a tiny gasp. She could hardly hear herself.
Leave me alone!
Now he was right on the other side of the door by the sound.
Oh, my God, he sounds as if he's gone crazy. Can that be? How can that be? What's happened since he dropped me off at Amanda's?
But there were no answers to these questions. There was only ache. And so she crept away upstairs, got her beautiful new doll from the closet in the sewing room, and then went into the bedroom. She eased off her shoes and then lay down on her side of the bed with the doll in her arms. Somewhere, far off, she heard conflicting sirens. She paid them no attention. Their bedroom was lovely at this time of day, full of bright October sunshine. Myrtle did not see it. She saw only darkness. She felt only misery, a deep, sick misery that not even the gorgeous doll could alleviate. The misery seemed to fill her throat and block her breathing. Oh, she had been so happy today, so very happy. He had been happy, too. She was sure of it. And now things were worse than they had been before. Much worse. What had happened? Oh, God, what had happened and who was responsible? Myrtle hugged the doll and looked up at the ceiling, and after a while she began to weep in large, flat sobs that made her whole body quake. At 15 minutes to midnight on that long, long Sunday in October, a door in the basement of Kennebec Valley Hospital's state wing opened, and Sheriff Alan Pangborn stepped through. He walked slowly with his head down. His feet, clad in elasticized hospital slippers, shuffled on the linoleum. The sign on the door behind him could be read as it swung shut. Morgue. Unauthorized entry prohibited. At the far end of the corridor, a janitor in gray fatigues was using a buffer to polish the floor in slow, lazy sweeps. Alan walked toward him, stripping the hospital cap off his head as he went. He lifted the green gown he was wearing and stuffed the cap in a back pocket of the blue jeans he wore beneath. The soft drone of the buffer made him feel sleepy. A hospital in Augusta was the last place on earth he wanted to be tonight. The janitor looked up as he approached and switched off his machine.
"You don't look so well, my friend," he greeted Alan. "I'm not surprised. Do you have a cigarette?"
The janitor took a pack of Luckies from his breast pocket and shook one out for Alan.
"You can't smoke it in here, though," he said.
He nodded his head toward the morgue door. "Doc Ryan throws a fit."
Alan nodded. "Where?"
The janitor took him to an intersecting corridor and pointed to a door about halfway down.
"That goes to the alley beside the building. Prop it open with something, though, or you'll have to go all the way around to the front to get back in. You got matches?"
Alan started down the corridor. "I carry a lighter. Thanks for the smoke."
"I heard it was a double feature in there tonight," the janitor called after him.
"That's right," Alan said without turning around.
"Autopsies are bastards, ain't they?"
"Yes," Alan said. Behind him, the soft drone of the floor buffer recommenced. They were bastards, all right. The autopsies of Nettie Cobb and Wilma Jurczyk had been the 23rd and 24th of his career, and they had all been bastards, but these two had been the worst, by far. The door the janitor had pointed out was the sort equipped with a panic bar. Alan looked around for something he could use to prop it open and saw nothing. He pulled the green gown off, wadded it up, and opened the door. Night air washed in, chilly but incredibly refreshing after the stale alcohol smell of the morgue and adjoining autopsy room. Alan placed the wadded-up gown against the door jamb and stepped out. He carefully let the door swing back, saw the gown would keep the latch from engaging, and forgot about it. He leaned against the cinder block wall next to the pencil line of light escaping through the slightly ajar door and lit his cigarette. The first puff made his head feel swimmy. He had been trying to quit for almost 2 years and kept almost making it. Then something would come up. That was both the curse and blessing of police work. Something always came up. He looked up at the stars, which he usually found calming and couldn't see many. The high-intensity lights which ringed the hospital dulled them out. He could make out the Big Dipper, Orion, and a faint reddish point that was probably Mars, but that was all. Mars, he thought. That's it. That's undoubtedly it. The warlords of Mars landed in Castle Rock around noon, and the first people they met were Nettie and the Jurczyk bitch. The warlords bit them and turned them rabid. It's the only thing that fits. He thought about going in and telling Henry Ryan, the state of Maine's chief medical examiner, "It was a case of alien intervention, Doc. Case closed." He doubted if Ryan would be amused. It had been a long night for him, too. Alan dragged deeply on the cigarette. It tasted absolutely grand, swimmy head or no swimmy head, and he felt he could understand perfectly why smoking was now off limits in the public areas of every hospital in America. John Calvin had been dead right. Nothing that made you feel this way could possibly be good for you. In the meantime, though, hit me with that nicotine, boss. It feels so fine. He thought idly of how nice it would be to buy an entire carton of these self-same Luckies, rip off both ends, and then light up the whole goddamn thing with a blowtorch. He thought how nice it would be to get drunk. This would be a very bad time to get drunk, he supposed. Another inflexible rule of life. When you really need to get drunk, you can never afford to do it. Alan wondered vaguely if maybe the alcoholics of the world weren't the only ones who really had their priorities straight. The pencil line of light by his feet fattened to a bar. Alan looked around and saw Norris Ridgwick. Norris stepped out and leaned against the wall next to Alan. He was still wearing his green cap, but it was askew, and the tie ribbons hung down over the back of his gown. His complexion matched his gown.
"Jesus, Alan. They were your first ones, weren't they?"
"No, I saw an autopsy case once when I was in North Windham. Smoke inhalation case. But these..."
"Jesus, Alan."
"Yeah," he said, and exhaled smoke. "Jesus. You got another cigarette?" "No, sorry. I bummed this one from the janitor." He looked at the deputy with mild curiosity. "I didn't know you smoked, Norris."
"I don't. I thought I might start."
Alan laughed softly. "Man, I can't wait to go out fishing tomorrow. Or our off days on hold while we sort this mess out." Alan thought about it, then shook his head. It hadn't really been the warlords of Mars. This business actually looked quite simple. In a way, that was what made it so horrible. He saw no reason to cancel Norris's off days.
"That's great," Norris said, and then added, "But I'll come in if you want, Alan. No problem."
"Shouldn't need you, Norris," he said. "John and Clut have both been in touch with me. Clut went with the CID guys to talk with Pete Jerzyk, and John went with the team investigating Nettie's end. They've both been in touch. It's pretty clear. Nasty, but clear."
And it was. Yet he was troubled about it just the same. On some deep level, he was very troubled indeed.
"Well, what happened? I mean, the Jerzyk bitch has been asking for it for years, but when somebody finally called her bluff, I thought she'd end up with a black eye or a broken arm. Nothing like this. Was it just a case of picking on the wrong person?"
"I think that pretty well covers it," Alan said. "Wilma couldn't have picked a worse person in Castle Rock to start a feud with."
"Feud?" "Polly gave Nettie a puppy last spring. It barked a little at first. Wilma did a lot of bitching about it."
"Really? I don't remember a complaint sheet."
"She only made the one official complaint. I caught it. Polly asked me if I would. She felt partially responsible since she gave Nettie the dog in the first place. Nettie said she'd keep him inside as much as she could, and that finished it for me. The dog stopped the barking, but Wilma apparently went on bitching to Nettie. Polly says that Nettie had crossed the street when she saw Wilma coming, even if Wilma was two blocks away. Nettie did everything but fork the sign of the evil eye at her. Then, last week, she crossed the line. She went over to the Jerzyks while Pete and Wilma were at work, saw the sheets hanging on the line, and covered them with mud from the garden."
Norris whistled. "Did we catch that complaint, Alan?"
Alan shook his head. From then until this afternoon, it was all between the ladies.
"What about Pete Jerzyk? Do you know Pete?"
"Well..." Norris stopped. Thought about Pete. Thought about Wilma. Thought about the two of them together. Slowly nodded his head. He was afraid Wilma would chew him up one side and down the other if he tried playing referee, so he stood aside. "Is that it?"
"Sort of. He actually may have headed things off, at least for a while. Clut says Pete told the CID guys that Wilma wanted to go over to Nettie's as soon as she got a look at her sheets. She was ready to rock and roll. She apparently called Nettie on the phone and told her she was going to rip off her head and shit down her neck."
Norris nodded. Between the autopsy on Wilma and the autopsy on Nettie, he had called dispatch in Castle Rock and asked for a list of complaints involving each of the two women. Nettie's list was short. One item. She had snapped and killed her husband. End of story. No flare-ups before and none since, including the last few years she'd spent back in town. Wilma was a different kettle of tripe entirely. She had never killed anyone, but the list of complaints, those made by her and those made about her, was a long one and went back to what had then been Castle Rock Junior High, where she had punched a substitute teacher in the eye for giving her detention. On two occasions, worried women who'd had the ill luck or judgment to get into Wilma's bad books had requested police protection. Wilma had also been the subject of three assault complaints over the years. Ultimately, all charges had been dropped, but it didn't take much study to figure out that no one in his or her right mind would have chosen Wilma Jerzyk to fuck with. "They were bad medicine for each other," Norris murmured. "The worst." "Her husband talked Wilma out of going over there the first time she wanted to go?" "Huh, he knew better than to even try. He told Clut he dropped two Xanax into a cup of tea, and that lowered her thermostat. In fact, Jerzyk says he thought it was all over. Do you believe him, Alan?"
"Yeah, as much as I can believe anyone without actually talking to them face to face, that is."
"What's the stuff he dropped into her tea? Dope?"
"A tranquilizer. Jerzyk told CID he'd used it a couple of times before when she got hot, and it cooled her out pretty well. He said he thought it did this time, too."
"But it didn't."
"I think it did, at first. Wilma just didn't go over and start chewing Nettie's ass, at least. But I'm pretty sure she went on harassing Nettie. It's the pattern she established when it was just the dog they were fighting over, making phone calls, doing drive-bys, that sort of thing. Nettie's skin was pretty thin. Stuff like that would have really gotten to her. John LaPointe and the CID team I stuck him with went to see Polly around 7 o'clock. Polly said she was pretty sure that Nettie was worried about something. She was over to see Polly this morning and let something slip then.
Polly didn't understand it at the time. Alan sighed. I guess now she wishes she'd listened a little more closely.
How's Polly taking it, Alan?
Pretty well, I think.
He had spoken to her twice, once from a house near the crime scene, and a second time from here at KVH, just after he and Norris had arrived. On both occasions, her voice had been calm and controlled, but he had sensed the tears and confusion just under the carefully maintained surface. He wasn't entirely surprised during the first call to find she already knew most of what had happened. News, particularly bad news, travels fast in small towns.
What set off the big bang?
Alan looked at Norris, surprised, and then realized he didn't know yet. Alan had gotten a more or less complete report from John LaPointe between the autopsies, while Norris had been on another phone talking to Sheila Brigham and compiling lists of complaints involving the two women. One of them decided to escalate, he said. My guess is Wilma, but the details of the picture are still hazy. Apparently Wilma went over to Nettie's while Nettie was visiting Polly this morning. Nettie must have left without locking her door or even latching it securely, and the wind blew it open. You know how windy it was today.
Yeah.
So, maybe it started out to be just another drive-by to keep Nettie's water hot. Then Wilma saw the door standing open and the drive-by turned into something else. Maybe it wasn't quite that way, but it feels right to me. The words weren't even out of his mouth before he recognized them as a lie. It didn't feel right. That was the trouble. It should have felt right. He wanted it to feel right, and it didn't. What was driving him crazy was that there was no reason for that sense of wrongness, at least none he could put his finger on. The closest he could come was to wonder if Nettie would have been careless not only about locking her door, but about shutting it tightly, if she was as paranoid about Wilma Jurzik as she had seemed. And that wasn't enough to hang a suspicion on. It wasn't enough because not all of Nettie's gear was stowed tightly, and you couldn't make any assumptions about what such a person would and wouldn't do. Still,
what did Wilma do? Norris asked. Trash the place?
Killed Nettie's dog.
What?
You heard me.
Jesus, what a bitch!
Well, but we knew that about her, didn't we?
Yeah, but still.
There it was again. Even from Norris Ridgwick, who could be depended on, even after all these years, to fill out at least 20% of his paperwork bass-ackwards.
Yeah, but still.
She did it with a Swiss Army knife, used the corkscrew attachment, and stuck a note on it saying it was payback for Nettie slinging mud at her sheets. So Nettie went over to Wilma's with a bunch of rocks. She wrapped notes of her own around them with rubber bands. The note said the rocks were Wilma's last warning. She threw them through all the Jurzik's downstairs windows.
Mother of God,
Norris said, not without some admiration. The Jurzik's left for 11 o'clock mass at 10:30 or so. After mass, they had lunch with the Pulaskis. Pete Jurzik stayed to watch the Patriots with Jake Pulaski, so there was no way he could even try to cool Wilma out this time.
Did they meet on that corner by accident? Norris asked.
I doubt it. I think Wilma got home, saw the damage, and called Nettie out.
You mean, like in a duel?
That's what I mean. Norris whistled, then stood quietly for a few moments, hands clasped behind his back, looking out into the darkness.
Alan, why are we supposed to attend these goddamn autopsies anyway? He asked at last.
Protocol, I guess, Alan said, but it was more than that, at least for him.
If you were troubled about the look of a case, or the feel of it, as he was troubled by the look and feel of this one, you might see something that would knock your brain out of neutral and into one of the forward gears. You might see a hook to hang your hat on.
Well, then I think it's time the county hired a protocol officer, Norris grumbled, and Alan laughed.
He wasn't laughing inside, though, and not just because this was going to hit Polly so hard over the next few days. Something about the case wasn't right. Everything looked all right on top, but down in the place where instinct lived, and sometimes hid, the Martian warlord still seemed to make more sense, at least to Alan.
Hey, come on. Didn't you just lay it out for Norris, A to Z, in the length of time it takes to smoke a cigarette?
Yes, he had. That was part of the trouble. Did two women, even when one was half nuts and the other was poison mean, meet on a street corner and cut each other to ribbons like a couple of hopped-up crack addicts for such simple reasons? Alan didn't know. And because he didn't know, he flipped the cigarette away and began to go over the whole thing again. For Alan, it began with a call from Andy Clutterbuck. Alan had just turned off the Patriots-Jets game. The Patriots were already down by a touchdown and a field goal, and the second quarter was less than 3 minutes old, and was putting on his coat when the phone rang. Alan had been intending to go down to Needful Things and see if Mr. Gaunt was there. It was even possible, Alan supposed, that he might meet Polly there after all. The call from Clut had changed all that. Eddie Warburton, Clut said, had been hanging up the phone just as he, Clut, came back from lunch. There had been some sort of ruckus going on over in the Tree Street section of town. Women fighting or something. It might be a good idea, Eddie said, if Clut were to call the sheriff and tell him about the trouble. What in the blue hell is Eddie Warburton doing answering the sheriff's office telephone? Alan asked irritably. Well, I guess with the dispatch office empty, he thought, what's he doing thinking, for that matter? He knows the procedure as well as anyone. When dispatch is empty, let the bastard route the incoming calls. I don't know why he answered the phone, Clut said with barely concealed impatience, but I don't think that's the important thing. Second call on the incident came in 4 minutes ago while I was talking with Eddie. An old lady, I didn't get a name, either she was too upset to give me one or she just didn't want to. Anyhow, she says there's been some sort of serious fight on the corner of Ford and Willow, two women involved. Caller says they were using knives. She says they're still there. Still fighting? No, down, both of them. The fight's over. Right. Alan's mind began clicking along faster, like an express train picking up speed. You logged the call, Clut. You bet I did. Good. Seaton's on this afternoon, isn't he? Get him out there right away. Already sent him. God bless you. Now call the state police. Do you want the CIU? Not yet. For the time being, just alert them to the situation. I'll meet you there, Clut. When he got to the crime scene and saw the extent of the damage, Alan radioed the Oxford barracks of the state police and told them to send a crime investigation unit right away, two if they could spare them. By then, Clut and Seaton Thomas were standing in front of the downed women with their arms spread, telling people to go back into their homes. Norris arrived, took a look, then got a roll of yellow tape marked Crime Scene, Do Not Cross, out of the trunk of his cruiser. There was a thick coating of dust on the tape, and Norris told Alan later that he hadn't been sure it would stick. It was so old. It had, though. Norris strung it around the trunks of oak trees, forming a large triangle around the two women who appeared to be embracing at the foot of the stop sign. The spectators had not returned to their houses, but did retreat to their own lawns. There were about 50 of them, and the number was growing as calls were made and neighbors hurried over to view the wreckage. Andy Clutterbuck and Seaton Thomas looked almost jumpy enough to pull their pieces and start firing warning shots. Alan sympathized with the way they felt. In Maine, the Criminal Investigation Department of the state police handles murder investigations, and for small fry fuzz, which is almost all of them, the scariest time comes between the discovery of the crime and the arrival of CID. Local cops and county mounties both know perfectly well that is the time when the so-called chain of evidence is most often broken. Most also know that what they do during that time will be closely scrutinized by Monday morning quarterbacks, most of them from the judiciary and the attorney general's office, who believe that small fry fuzz, even the county boys, are a bunch of deputy dogs with ham hands and fumble fingers. Also, those silent bunches of people standing on the lawns across the street were goddamn spooky. They reminded Alan of the mall zombies in Dawn of the Dead. He got the battery-powered bullhorn out of the back seat of his cruiser and told them he wanted them to go inside right away. They began to do it. He then reviewed the protocol in his head one more time and radioed dispatch. Sandra McMillan had come in to handle the chores there. She wasn't as steady as Sheila Brigham, but beggars could not be choosers, and Alan guessed Sheila would hear what had happened and come in before much longer. If her sense of duty didn't bring her, curiosity would. Alan told Sandy to track down Ray Van Allen. Ray was Castle County's on-call medical examiner, also the county coroner, and Alan wanted him here when CID arrived, if that was possible. Roger, Sheriff, Sandy said self-importantly. Base is clear. Alan went back to his officers on the scene. Which one of you verified that the women are dead?
Klutt and Seat Thomas looked at each other in uneasy surprise, and Alan felt his heart sink.
1 point for the Monday morning quarterbacks, or maybe not.
The first crime investigation unit wasn't here yet, although we could hear more sirens approaching.
Alan ducked under the tape and approached the stop sign, walking on tiptoe like a kid trying to sneak out of the house after curfew.
The spilled blood was mostly pooled between the victims and in the leaf-choked gutter beside them, but a fine spray of droplets, what the forensics boys called backsplatter, dotted the area around them in a rough circle.
Alan dropped on one knee just outside this circle, stretched out a hand, and found he could reach the corpses. He had no doubt that was what they were, by leaning forward to the very edge of balance with one arm stretched out. He looked back at Seat, Norris, and Klutt. They were clustered together in a knot, staring at him with big eyes.
"Photograph me," he said.
Klutt and Seaton only looked at him as if he had given an order in Tagalog, but Norris ran to Alan's cruiser and rooted around in the back until he found the old Polaroid there, one of two they used for taking crime scene photographs. When the Appropriations Committee met, Alan was planning to ask for at least one new camera, but this afternoon the Appropriations Committee meeting seemed very unimportant.
Norris hurried back with the camera, aimed, and triggered it. The drive whined.
"Better take another one just to be safe," Alan said. "Get the bodies, too. I'm not going to have those guys saying we broke the chain of evidence. Be damned if I will."
He was aware that his voice sounded a shade querulous, but there was nothing he could do about it.
Norris took another Polaroid, documenting Alan's position outside the circle of evidence and the way the bodies were lying against the foot of the stop sign. Then Alan leaned cautiously forward again and placed his fingers against the blood-stained neck of the woman lying on top. There was no pulse, of course, but after a second the pressure of his fingers caused her head to fall away from the signpost and turn sideways. Alan recognized Nettie at once, and it was Polly he thought of.
"Oh, Jesus," he thought dolefully.
Then he went through the motions of feeling for Wilma's pulse, even though there was a meat cleaver buried in her skull. Her cheeks and forehead were printed with small dots of blood. They looked like heathen tattoos. Alan got up and returned to where his men were standing on the other side of the tapes. He couldn't seem to stop thinking of Polly, and he knew that was wrong. He had to get her off his mind, or he was going to bitch this up for sure. He wondered if any of the gawkers had ID'd Nettie already. If so, Polly would surely hear before he could call her. He hoped desperately that she wouldn't come down to see for herself.
"You can't worry about that now," he admonished himself. "You've got a double murder on your hands from the look."
"Get out your book," he told Norris. "You're club secretary."
"Jesus, Alan, you know how lousy my spelling is."
"Just right." Norris gave the Polaroid to Klutt and got his notebook out of his back pocket. A pad of traffic warnings with his name rubber-stamped at the bottom of each sheet fell out with it. Norris bent, picked the pad up off the sidewalk and stuffed it absently into his pocket again. "I want you to note that the head of the woman on top, designated Victim 1, was resting against the post of the stop sign. I inadvertently pushed it off, checking for pulse."
How easy it is to slip into police speak, Alan thought, where cars become vehicles and crooks become perpetrators and dead townspeople become designated victims. Police speak, the wonderful sliding glass barrier.
He turned to Klutt and told him to photograph this second configuration of the bodies, feeling extremely grateful that he'd had Norris document the original position before he touched the women.
Klutt took the picture.
Alan turned back to Norris. "I want you to further note that when the head of Victim 1 moved, I was able to identify her as Natisha Cobb."
Seaton whistled. "You mean it's Nettie?"
"Yes, that's what I mean." Norris wrote the information down on his pad. Then he asked,
"Well, what do we do now, Alan?"
"Wait for CID's investigation unit and try to look alive when they get here," Alan said.
The CIU arrived less than 3 minutes later in two cars, followed by Ray Van Allen in his cranky old Subaru Brat. 5 minutes later, a state police ID team arrived in a blue station wagon. All the members of the state police team then lit cigars. Alan had known they would do this. The bodies were fresh and they were outdoors, but the ritual of the cigars was immutable. The unpleasant work known in police speak as securing the scene began.
It went on until after dark. Alan had worked with Henry Payton, head of the Oxford Barracks, and thus in nominal charge of this case and the CIU guys working it, on several other occasions. He had never seen the slightest hint of imagination in Henry. The man was a plotter, but a thorough, conscientious plotter. It was because Henry had been assigned that Alan had felt safe to creep off for a bit and call Polly. When he returned, the hands of the victims were being secured in gallon-sized Ziploc baggies. Wilma Jerzyk had lost one of her shoes, and her stockinged foot was accorded the same treatment. The ID team moved in and took close to 300 photos. More state police had arrived by then. Some held back the crowd, which was trying to draw closer again, and others shunted the arriving TV people down to the municipal building. A police artist did a quick sketch on a crime scene grid. At last, the bodies themselves were taken care of, except that was for one final matter. Payton gave Alan a pair of disposable surgical gloves and a Ziploc baggie. The cleaver or the knife? I'll take the cleaver, Alan said. It would be the messier of the two implements, still clotted with Wilma Jerzyk's brains, but he didn't want to touch Nettie. He had liked her. With the murder weapons removed, tagged, bagged, and on their way to Augusta, the two CIU teams moved in and began to search the area around the bodies, which still lay in their terminal embrace, with the blood pooled between them, now hardening to a substance like enamel. When Ray Van Allen was finally allowed to load them into the medical assistance van, the scene was lit with police cruiser high beams, and the orderlies first had to peel Wilma and Nettie apart. During most of this, Castle Rock's finest stood around feeling like bumps on a log. Henry Payton joined Alan on the sidelines during the conclusion of the oddly delicate ballet known as on-scene investigation. "Lousy damned way to spend a Sunday afternoon," he said. Alan nodded. "I'm sorry the head moved on you. That was bad luck." Alan nodded again. "I don't think anyone's going to bother you about it, though. You got at least one good pick of the original position." He looked toward Norris, who was talking with Clutt and the newly arrived John LaPointe. "You're just lucky that old boy there didn't put his finger over the lens." "Aw, Norris is all right. So's KY Jelly in its place. Anyway, the whole thing looks pretty simple." Alan agreed. That was the trouble. He had known that long before he and Norris finished their Sunday tour of duty in an alley behind Kennebec Valley Hospital. The whole thing was too pretty simple, maybe. "You planning to attend the cutting party?" Henry asked. "Yes. Is Ryan going to do it?" "That's what I understand. I thought I might take Norris with me. The bodies will go to Oxford first, won't they?" "Uh-huh. That's where we log them in. If Norris and I left now, we could be in Augusta before they get there." Henry Payton nodded. "Why not? I think it's buttoned up here." "I'd like to send one of my men with each of your CIU teams, as observers. Do you have a problem with that?" Payton thought it over. "Nope. But who's going to keep the peace? Old Seat Thomas?" Alan felt a sudden flash of something which was a little too hot to be dismissed as mere annoyance. It had been a long day. He listened to Henry rag on his deputies about as much as he wanted to. Yet he needed to stay on Henry's good side in order to hitch a ride on what was technically a state police case, and so he held his tongue. "Come on, Henry. It's Sunday night. Even the Mellow Tigers closed." "Why are you so hot to stick with this, Alan? Is there something hinky about it? I understand there was bad feeling between the two women, and that the one on top already offed someone, her husband no less." Alan thought about it. "No, nothing hinky. Nothing that I know about, anyway. It's just that..." "It doesn't quite gel in your head yet?" "Something like that." "Okay. Just as long as your men understand that they're there to listen and no more." Alan smiled a little. He thought of telling Payton that if he instructed Clutt and John LaPointe to ask questions, they would probably run the other way, and decided not to. "They'll keep their lips zipped," he said. "You can count on it." And so here they were, he and Norris Ridgwick, after the longest Sunday in living memory. But the day had one thing in common with the lives of Nettie and Wilma. It was over. "Were you thinking about checking into a motel room for the night?" Norris asked hesitantly. Alan didn't have to be a mind reader to know what he was thinking about, the fishing he would miss tomorrow. "Hell no." Alan bent and picked up the gown he had used to prop the door open. "Let's beat feet." Great idea, Norris said, sounding happy for the first time since Alan had met him at the crime scene. 5 minutes later, they were headed toward Castle Rock along Route 43, the headlights of the county cruiser boring holes in the windy darkness. By the time they arrived, it had been Monday morning for almost 3 hours. Alan pulled in behind the municipal building and got out of the cruiser. His station wagon was parked next to Norris's dilapidated VW Beetle on the far side of the lot. You headed right home? He asked Norris. Norris offered a small, embarrassed grin and dropped his eyes. Soon's I change into my civvies. Norris, how many times have I told you about using the men's room as a changing booth? Come on, Alan, I don't do it all the time. They both knew, however, that Norris did just that. Alan sighed. Never mind, it's been a hell of a long day for you. I'm sorry. Norris shrugged. It was murder. They don't happen around here very often. When they do, I guess everybody pulls together. Get Sandy or Sheila to write you up an overtime chit if either of them is still here. And give Buster something else to bitch about? Norris laughed with some bitterness. Huh, I think I'll pass. This one's on me, Alan. Has he been giving you shit? Alan had forgotten all about the town's head selectman these last couple of days. No, but he gives me a real hairy eyeball when we pass on the street. If looks could kill, I'd be as dead as Nettie and Wilma. I'll write up the chit myself tomorrow morning. If your name's on it, that's okay, Norris said, starting for the door marked Town Employees Only. Good night, Alan. Good luck with the fishing. Norris brightened at once. Thanks. You should see the rod I got down at the new store, Alan. It's a dandy. Alan grinned. I bet it is. I keep meaning to go see that fellow. He seems to have something for everyone else in town, so why not something for me? Why not? Norris agreed. He's got all kinds of stuff, all right. You'd be surprised. Good night, Norris, and thanks again. Don't mention it. But Norris was clearly pleased. Alan got into his car, backed out of the lot, and turned down Main Street. He checked the buildings on both sides automatically, not even registering his own examination, but storing the information just the same. One of the things he noticed was the fact that there was a light on in the living area above Needful Things. It was mighty late for small town folks to be up. He wondered if Mr. Leland Gaunt was an insomniac and reminded himself again that he had that call to make. But it would keep, he reckoned, until he had the sad business of Nettie and Wilma sorted out to his satisfaction. He reached the corner of Main and Laurel, signaled a left turn, then halted in the middle of the intersection and turned right instead. To hell with going home. That was a cold and empty place with his remaining son living it up with his friend on Cape Cod. There were too many closed doors with too many memories lurking behind them in that house. On the other side of town, there was a live woman who might need someone quite badly just now. Almost as badly, perhaps, as this live man needed her. 5 minutes later, Alan killed the headlights and rolled quietly up Polly's driveway. The door would be locked, but he knew which corner of the porch steps to look under. What are you still doing here, Sandy? Norris asked as he walked in, loosening his tie. Sandra McMillan, a fading blonde who had been the county's part-time dispatcher for almost 20 years, was slipping into her coat. She looked very tired. Sheila had tickets to see Bill Cosby in Portland, she told Norris. She said she'd stay here, but I made her go, practically pushed her out the door. I mean, how often does Bill Cosby come to Maine? How often do two women decide to cut each other to pieces over a dog that probably came from the Castle County Animal Shelter in the first place, Norris thought, but did not say. Not that often, I guess. Hardly ever. Sandy sighed deeply. Tell you a secret, though. Now that it's all over, I almost wish I'd said yes when Sheila offered to stay. It's been so crazy tonight. I think every TV station in the state called at least 9 times. And until 11 o'clock or so, this place looked like a department store Christmas Eve sale. Well, go on home. You have my permission. Did you power up the Bastard? The Bastard was the machine which switched calls to Alan's home when no dispatcher was on duty at the station. If no one picked up at Allen's after 4 rings, the Bastard cut in and told callers to dial the state police in Oxford. It was a jury-rigged system that wouldn't have worked in a big city, but in Castle County, which had the smallest population of all Maine's 16 counties, It worked fine. It's on. Good. I have a feeling that Alan might not have been going straight home. Sandy raised her eyebrows knowingly. Hear anything from Lieutenant Peyton? Norris asked. Not a thing. She paused. Was it awful, Norris? I mean, those two women?
It was pretty awful, all right, he agreed.
His civvies were hung neatly on a hanger he had hooked over a filing cabinet handle. He removed it and started for the men's room. It had been his habit to change in and out of his uniforms at work for the last 3 years or so, although the changes rarely came at such an outrageous hour as this. Go home, Sandy. I'll lock up when I'm done. He pushed through the bathroom door and hooked the hanger over the top of the door to the toilet stall. He was unbuttoning his uniform shirt when there was a light knock on the door. Norris, Sandy called.
I think I'm the only one here, he called back.
I almost forgot. Someone left a present for you. It's on your desk.
Norris paused in the act of unbuckling his pants.
A present? Who from?
I don't know. The place really was a madhouse, but it's got a card on it. Also a bow. It must be your secret lover.
My lover's so secret even I don't know about her, Norris said with real regret. He stepped out of his pants and laid them over the stall door while he put on his jeans. Outside, Sandy McMillan smiled with a touch of malice. Mr. Keaton was by tonight, she said. Maybe he left it. Maybe it's a kiss-and-make-up present.
Norris laughed. That'll be the day.
Well, make sure you tell me tomorrow. I'm dying to know. It's a pretty package. Good night, Norris.
Night.
Who could have left me a present, he wondered, taking off his uniform pants and shaking them out carefully along the crease. Sandy left, pulling the collar of her coat up as she went out. The night was very cold, reminding her that winter was on its way. Cindy Rose Martin, the lawyer's wife, was one of the many people she had seen that night. Cindy Rose had turned up early in the evening. Sandy never thought of mentioning her to Norris, however. He did not move in the Martins' more rarefied social and professional circles. Cindy Rose had said she was looking for her husband, which made a certain amount of sense to Sandy, although the evening had been so harum-scarum that Sandy probably wouldn't have thought it odd if the woman had said she was looking for Mikhail Baryshnikov, because Albert Martin did some of the town's legal work. Sandy said she hadn't seen Mr. Martin that evening, although Cindy Rose was welcome to check upstairs and see if he was in with Mr. Keaton, if she wanted. Cindy Rose said she thought she would do that, as long as she was here. By then, the switchboard was lit up like a Christmas tree again, and Sandy did not see Cindy Rose take the rectangular package with the bright foil paper and the blue velvet bow from her large handbag and put it on Norris Ridgewick's desk. Her pretty face had been lit with a smile as she did it, but the smile itself was not pretty at all. It was, in fact, rather cruel. Norris heard the outer door shut and dimly the sound of Sandy starting her car. He tucked his shirt into his jeans, stepped into his loafers, and arranged his uniform on its hanger. He sniffed the shirt at the armpits and decided it didn't have to go to the cleaners right away. That was good. A penny saved was a penny earned. When he left the men's room, he put the hanger back on the same file cabinet handle, where he could not help seeing it on his way out. That was also good, because Alan got pissed like a bear when Norris forgot and left his duds hanging around the police station. He said it made the place look like a laundromat. He went over to his desk. Someone really had left him a present. It was a box done up in light blue foil wrapping paper and blue velvet ribbon exploding into a fluffy bow on top. There was a square white envelope tucked under the ribbon. Very curious now, Norris removed the envelope and tore it open. There was a card inside. Typed on it, in capital letters, was a short, enigmatic message. Just a reminder. He frowned. The only two persons he could think of who were always reminding him of things were Alan and his mother had died 5 years ago. He picked up the package, broke the ribbon, and set the bow carefully aside. Then he took off the paper, revealing a plain white cardboard box. It was about a foot long, 4 inches wide, and 4 inches deep. The lid was taped shut. Norris broke the tape and opened the box. There was a layer of white tissue paper over the object inside, thin enough to indicate a flat surface with a number of raised ridges running across it, but not thin enough to allow him to see what his present was. He reached in to pull the tissue paper out, and his forefinger struck something hard, a protruding tongue of metal. A heavy steel jaw closed on the tissue paper and also on Norris Ridgwick's first three fingers. Pain ripped up his arm. He screamed and stumbled backward, grabbing his right wrist with his left hand. The white box tumbled to the floor. Tissue paper crinkled. Oh, son of a bitch, it hurt! He grabbed at the tissue, which hung down in a wrinkled ribbon, and tore it free. What he revealed was a large Victory rat trap. Someone had armed it, stuck it in the box, put tissue paper over it to hide it, and then wrapped it in pretty blue paper. Now it was clamped on the first three fingers of his right hand. It had torn the nail of his index finger right off, he saw. All that remained was a bleeding crescent of raw flesh. "Whoremaster!" Norris cried. In his pain and shock, he had first beat the trap against the side of John LaPointe's desk instead of just prying back the steel bar. All he managed to do was bang his hurt fingers against the desk's metal corner and send a fresh snarl of pain up his arm. He screamed again, then grabbed the trap's bar and pulled it back. He released his fingers and dropped the trap. The steel bar snapped down again on the trap's wooden base as it fell to the floor. Norris stood trembling for a moment, then bolted back into the men's room, turned on the cold water with his left hand, and thrust his right hand under the tap. It throbbed like an impacted wisdom tooth. He stood with his lips drawn back in a grimace, watching thin threads of blood swirl down the drain, and thought of what Sandy had said. Mr. Keaton was by. Maybe it's a kiss-and-make-up present. And the card. Just a reminder. Oh, it had been Buster, all right. He didn't doubt it a bit. It was just Buster's style. You son of a bitch, Norris groaned. The cold water was numbing his fingers, damping down that sick throbbing, but he knew it would be back by the time he arrived home. Aspirin might dull it a little, but he still thought he could forget about getting any real sleep tonight, or any fishing tomorrow, for that matter. Oh, yes, I will. I'll go fishing even if my fucking hand falls fucking off. I had it planned, I've been looking forward to it, and Danforth fucking Buster Keaton isn't going to stop me. He turned off the water and used a paper towel to blot his hand gently dry. None of the fingers which had been caught in the trap were broken, at least he didn't think so, but they were already beginning to swell, cold water or no cold water. The arm of the trap had left a dark red-purple weal which ran across the fingers between the first and second knuckles. The exposed flesh beneath what had been the nail of his index finger was sweating small beads of blood, and that sick throbbing was already beginning again. He went back into the deserted bullpen and looked at the sprung trap lying on its side by John's desk. He picked it up and went over to his own desk. He put the trap inside the gift box and put it in the top drawer of his desk. He took his aspirin out of the lower drawer and shook three of them into his mouth. Then he got the tissue paper, the wrapping paper, the ribbon, and the bow. These he stuffed into the trash basket, covering them with balls of discarded paper. He had no intention of telling Alan or anyone else about the nasty trick Buster had played on him. They wouldn't laugh, but Norris knew what they would think, or thought he did. Only Norris Ridgwick would fall for something like that. Stuck his hand right into a loaded rat trap. Can you believe it? It must be your secret lover. Mr. Keaton was by tonight. Maybe it's a kiss-and-make-up present. I'll take care of this myself, Norris said in a low, grim voice. He was holding his wounded hand against his chest, in my own way and in my own time. Suddenly, a new and urgent thought came to him. What if Buster hadn't been content with the rat trap, which, after all, might not have worked? What if he had gone up to Norris's house? The basin fishing rod was there, and it wasn't even locked up. He had just leaned it in the corner of the shed next to his creel. What if Buster knew about it and had decided to break it in two? If he did that, I'd break him in two, Norris said. He spoke in a low, angry growl Henry Payton, nor many of his other law enforcement colleagues, for that matter, would not have recognized. He forgot all about locking up when he left the office. He had even temporarily forgotten about the pain in his hand. The only thing that mattered was getting home. Getting home and making sure the basin rod was still all right. ¶¶ The shape under the blankets didn't move when Alan eased into the room, and he thought Polly was asleep, probably with the help of a Percodan at bedtime. He undressed quietly and slid into bed beside her. As his head settled on the pillow, he saw that her eyes were open, watching him. It gave him a momentary start, and he jerked. "What stranger comes to this maiden's bed?" she asked softly. "Only I," he replied, smiling a little. "This one is in sorrow for waking you, maiden." "I was awake," she said, and put her arms around his neck. He slipped his own about her waist. The deep bed warmth of her pleased him. She was like a sleepy furnace. He felt something hard against his chest for a moment, and it almost registered that she was wearing something under her cotton nightgown. Then it shifted, tumbling down between her left breast and her armpit on its fine silver chain. "Are you okay?" he asked her. She pressed the side of her face against his cheek, still holding him. He could feel her hands locked together at the nape of his neck. "No," she said. The word came out in a trembling sigh, and then she began to sob. He held her while she cried, stroking her hair. "Why didn't she tell me what that woman was doing, Alan?" Polly asked at last. She drew away from him a little. Now his eyes had adjusted to the dark, and he could see her face. Dark eyes, dark hair, white skin. "I don't know," he said. "If she'd told me, I would have taken care of it. I would have gone to see Wilma Jurzik myself, and... It was not the moment to tell her that Nettie had apparently played the game with almost as much vigor and malice as Wilma herself. Nor was it the moment to tell her that there came a time when the Nettie Cobbs of the world, and the Wilma Jurziks too, he supposed, could no longer be fixed. There came a time when they went beyond anyone's ability to repair. "It's 3:30 in the morning," he said. "That's a bad time to talk about should-haves and would-haves." He hesitated for a moment before speaking again. "According to John LaPointe, Nettie said something to you about Wilma this morning, yesterday morning now. What was it?" Polly thought it over. "Well, I didn't know it was about Wilma, not then anyway. Nettie brought over a lasagna, and my hands were really bad." She saw it right away. Nettie may have been vague about some things, but I couldn't hide a thing from her. "She loved you very much," Alan said gravely, and this brought on a fresh spate of sobbing. He had known it would, just as he knew that some tears have to be cried no matter what the hour. Until they are, they simply rave and burn inside. After a while, Polly was able to go on. Her hands crept back around Alan's neck as she spoke. "She got those stupid thermal gloves out. Only this time they really seemed to help. The current crisis seems to have passed anyway. And then she made coffee. I asked her if she didn't have things to do at home, and she said she didn't. She said Raider was on guard, and then she said something like, 'I think she'll leave me alone anyway. I haven't seen her or heard from her, so I guess she finally got the message.' That isn't exact, Alan, but it's pretty close."
"What time did she come by?"
"Around 10:15. It might have been a little earlier or a little later, but not much. Why, Alan? Does it mean anything?"
When Alan slid between the sheets, he felt that he would be asleep 10 seconds after his head hit the pillow. Now he was wide awake again and thinking hard. "No," he said after a moment. "I don't think it means anything except that Nettie had Wilma on her mind."
"I just can't believe it. She seemed so much better. She